The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Frisch, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. And we have three matters that are consolidated for one oral hearing, and I understand from the message from the marshal that counsel is agreeable to the usual 15 minutes apiece and 5 minutes of rebuttal. We do ask that when you approach the podium, you do identify yourself for the record. I'll note for the record, we have the three files, 822-0965, 1613, and 1746. And so, counsel for appellant, you may approach, identify yourself, and then begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Mark Weinhardt from Des Moines, Iowa. With me here at council table is Kevin Keneally of the Stinson firm here in the Twin Cities, and in the gallery is Emily Asp, also co-counsel on this matter. In these three appeals, Partners in Nutrition challenges the Minnesota Department of Education's wholesale denial of the claims of hundreds of individual nonprofit organizations, what we call sites, who were sponsored by Partners and who looked to Partners to obtain for them reimbursement for the money that they invested in feeding needy children under the CACFP program. Notwithstanding the allegations of fraud in that program, with which everyone in this room is familiar, there were many nonprofits whose staffs behaved completely admirably and in good faith, and they have been left in the lurch for millions of dollars because MDE's reaction to those allegations of fraud has been to cut off funding to absolutely everyone associated with Partners in Nutrition, regardless of the facts of their individual cases or claims. We're appealing in order to get those good faith nonprofits an opportunity to have reimbursement for the money that they spent during the COVID pandemic. Now, the hundreds of claim denials in this case are predominantly justified by MDE's purported May 27th, 2022 termination of Partners in Nutrition as a sponsor under this program. That action was contrary to law and should be reversed. There are two sets of regulations that arguably deal with a termination of an institution in this program and the cutoff of funding to that institution.
Before you get into that, wouldn't it be safe to say that it's not surprising, of course, when there's a massive fraud in one organization that the rest of the organizations that are involved in it obviously will be subject to a greater scrutiny, and when you then look at the agreement that your client signed and any other party that doing the same thing and the regulations, the requirement to provide proof for the submissions, that's the normal process. So the process itself, while it might have been ramped up or made more thorough, should we say, by the Department of Education because of the indictments and the fraud in one organization, that's part of the requirement.
So I agree that that is part of the requirement. Our concern is not so much with the idea that there was elevated scrutiny as a result of the fraud. It is rather that MDE did not follow its regulatory duty to apportion between valid claims and invalid claims, but instead it threw all of the claims out without attempting to conduct a review of the valid portions of the claims. And the regulation on this, 226.14A in Title VII, is explicit. It says that the MDE has to apportion the valid from the invalid portions of these claims. It says that it can disallow any portion of a claim for reimbursement and recover any payment to an institution not properly payable under this part. MDE absolutely did not do that. And they don't contend that they don't have a duty to do that, but rather their contention is, well, it was just impractical. There were so many claims and so much difficulty in the documents that it would not be feasible for us to do that. Legally, there is no feasibility exception to that apportionment rule, but as a practical matter, MDE itself admits that it can apportion the claims. And this is what the MDE appeal panel said in the first pair of rulings, and what I'm going to quote to is from pages 17 and 37 of our addendum to our first opening brief. where the MDE appeal panel said that dealing with these individual sites, it can, and I'm quoting, determine on a case-by-case basis the compliance and validity of each claim and ensure that if a portion of a claim can be verified independently of the remainder of that claim, that portion will properly be paid. So MDE says that they can do that if they're dealing with the individual sites, but they won't go through the exact same analysis here. We know.
I mean, there was a reason for that. I mean, MDE did say, and the appeal panel did confirm, that the documents that were produced by your client were in such disarray, and it just made it impossible for them to be able to sort through them. And to be fair, your client didn't really help them out by saying, here are the five documents that demonstrate that this site in particular was improperly denied. Why didn't you do that?
So actually, in the third appeal, our client did submit a detailed spreadsheet in Excel form that's in the record in response to the MDE chart of what claims were being denied and why they were being denied. And so they did furnish that information. That's one reason why we know there are some valid claims in there. A second reason that we know that is that in the previous year, in 2021, there was a finding or an assignment of serious deficiency by MDE that required partners to submit its claim documentation in order to make sure that the claim documentation was up to snuff. And after only a few weeks, MDE decided that the documentation was adequate. And this is all in the helter-skelter of COVID. A year later, though, and this tellingly is after the federal criminal investigation comes to light, the same sites with the same kind of documentation were all just across the board denied. And they were denied for reasons that don't comport with reality. So, for example, there is a claim that there was a delivery of ingredients, not meals. Well, the unit of denial that MDE used was all of the meals for one site for 1 month. Well, if a site is doing two meals a day, a dinner and a snack, or a lunch and a snack, and it's doing them for 500 children, let's say, on the average, that's 30,000 meals, and they're treating those 30,000 meals as a unit. Well, it might be for the lunches that some of those meals consisted of ingredients and there was additional preparation that needed to be done and they shouldn't be compensable. However, snacks are self-contained. They are orange juice little boxes, and they are bags of cookies and things like that. And there are photographs in the record that show that was provided. And so there's certainly a compensable part of that claim, in my example of 30,000 meals. There are compensable parts to that, and that's what MDE needs to be able to work with our client in order to try to sift through. And that's what MDE in the first appeal said that they could do. They just didn't want to do it with partners. They only wanted to do it with the sites. There's no legal basis for that distinction.
Can I just turn your attention to the second appeal, which is the termination?
Sure.
I have some questions about the statutory interpretation argument. In your brief, you indicate that the language of the CACFP regulations is plain enough. I think that's your language, plain enough. I don't know what that means. Are you saying that it's unambiguous or that there is some ambiguity or there's some conflict between the CACFP regulations and the OMB regulations? It's just not clear to me what the
apologies for the perhaps loose language. What we meant to say was that the language is unambiguous and thus not susceptible to any deferential interpretation. But the much more important point about the May 27th termination is not the regulatory language, it is the statutory language. Because the School Lunch Act, and this is at 42 U.S.C., 1766 D5. We cite that in page 20 of our opening brief in the second appeal. That language says that if there's going to be a termination of an institution, that termination must happen pursuant to regulations promulgated by the Secretary of Agriculture, not anybody else. And the statute goes on to say that for there to be a termination, there must be a pre-termination hearing. That's not what happened here. And so we know that MDE did not follow the USDA statute. And even if there is deference owed to MDE in its interpretation of the regulations, there's no deference owed to them in terms of their interpretation of a federal statute. And it is settled law that a federal statute trumps conflicting regulations, whether they're in Title II or Title VII or any place else. But in fact, the OMB regulations that are championed by MDE, and we have this in our brief at pages 23 and 24, in two different places they say that if a statute conflicts with what those OMB regulations say, the statute prevails. And so it's clear that as a statutory matter, MDE was required to follow the USDA regulations, not the OMB regulations, in attempting to terminate partners in nutrition.
Mr. Meyer, just to clarify, so your point being is, obviously, once you look at that statutory provision, which requires the hearing, you already have answered, the answer has been given in terms of which regulation to look at.
Correct.
The OMB or the CACF regulation.
Exactly, and MDE knew that because
was that argument made to the appeal panel? I didn't see that in an analysis. I didn't think I saw it. I may have missed it. So what I saw seemed to be the main point of the appeal panel review was the permissive language in the OMB regulation versus the mandatory language, and that the department used the permissive language of OMB, and hence that became the regulation to use.
No, we argued Section 1766 in our statement of position to the appeal panel in that second appeal, and so that argument was made in the record. Additionally, MDE knew that it was supposed to use the USDA regulations rather than the OMB regulations, because that's where they started. In January of last year, on the 20th of the month, they issue this suspension, and on the 31st, they purport to issue this termination. But in both instances, they didn't follow the procedural rules under the USDA regulations, and their own appeal panel reversed them. And that's in the record, that opinion, and told them the path that they would have to follow, but they didn't follow that path. Instead, they switched horses in the middle of the stream and decided to use the OMB regulations instead. And that was a legal error that should be reversed. The one other thing that I would like to talk about for a moment is the presence of over 350 pages of federal criminal investigation documents as a basis for the decision here, which we believe was error. Today is almost 18 months to the day after this investigation went public, and the record is clear that MDE knew about the investigation months before that. Yet as we stand here today, no individual associated with Partners in Nutrition has been accused of a crime. Partners has never been told that it is a target of the investigation, unlike the other sponsor. MDE has never made a finding that Partners or any of its people engaged in fraud. MDE has never asserted in these proceedings that Partners submitted a single knowingly false or fraudulent claim. MDE talks about Partners' role or connection or involvement in this fraud, but those terms embrace what actually happened, which was that Partners was an unwitting conduit for money that was siphoned off downstream by certain of the sites who misbehaved, and even worse, certain of the vendors who misbehaved.
But one of those individuals is sort of all over the search warrants and federal investigative materials, it also appeared to be deeply connected to Partners.
Right, Mr. Scarver.
Yes. Has that individual been indicted, by the way?
He has not.
Okay.
No.
But I guess what I'm getting at is the connection there seems to be a little closer than maybe you're acknowledging.
So in my little litany there, everything that I said is consistent with where Mr. Scarver is, which is he appears in some affidavits and an indictment. He's never been charged himself. We've never been contacted about his status in this case. Let's concede for a moment the opposite. Let's assume that he had been indicted for the things that are written about him. That does not equate to partners having knowingly submitted any false or fraudulent claims, which under the USDA regulations, that's what they have to have done, or MDE had to have evidence of that for MDE to be able to summarily cut off their funding in the way that they did. And nothing about any of this, even again, if we concede the worst about Mr. Scarver, nothing about that would have anything to do with the analysis of whether under 226.14 you should be apportioning versus not apportioning claims based upon defects in the documentation, based upon snacks versus lunches, those sorts of things. The decisions that got made about the claim denials had nothing whatsoever to do with any of the fraudulent allegations. I see my time is up. Unless there are other questions, I will finish.
And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach, identify yourself, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Joe Weiner, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Education. This case involves the proper stewardship of funds intended for children and vulnerable adults under the Child and Adult Care Food Program. In 2018, MDE first informed partners about problems with its record keeping, documentation, and menu requirements, and then again raised concerns in March of 2021. It provided partners with a notice of serious deficiency and placed partners on notice that if these issues were not permanently corrected, it would begin a termination process. By late 2021, partners was claiming that it was serving approximately 70% of all the children in the state of Minnesota through the food, a child and adult care food program. And then in January of 2022, the Department of Justice unsealed search warrants that showed concerns that sites that partners had submitted had been embezzling funds and claiming that they had provided meals when that hadn't happened. At that point, MDE, invoking its authority under 7 CFR Part 226, required partners to provide more documentation, and after reviewing that documentation, denied over 700 claims for reimbursement between the time frame of November 2021 through May of 2022. Because of these record-keeping failures.
And so, Reinhardt, just to
certainly
follow up that last answer that Mr. Reinhardt just gave, I think the state agrees or concedes there is no evidence of fraud or knowingly fraudulent type of behavior, so that part of the regulation that requires immediate discharge does not apply. And despite the many references to names being named, including the one that we just talked about, who might be the closest name, the point being is there's no evidence that the relator itself, its organization, is involved in any of that.
Your Honor, there have been no specific findings of fraud as it relates to partners. There is evidence in the submitted affidavits that Mr. Scarver took a cut of the amount of money that was provided to, I believe it's the Free Mind Institute, which was he's serving on as the founder and creator of that institute, in addition to serving on the partner's board.
But to date, he's not been indicted, and to your knowledge, an indictment's not forthcoming.
We've had no discussions with the Department of Justice, so I don't know about that, and that is correct. He has not been indicted.
So that being the case, would you agree with the summary that really being named in the affidavits is somehow having some association, but absent any evidence otherwise, that's largely irrelevant, other than perhaps it gives reason to enhanced evaluation of the particular this relator and its submissions?
Your Honor, I do think that there's two pieces to that. The first is Mr. Scarver's position in that, and that he is there. I think you're correct, that does not play any role in whether or not as a basis for denial. It does provide more reason to engage in a more thorough investigation and requirement of those records. There have been a number of institutions that have pleaded guilty to fraud, and they are institutions that Partners has submitted claims for reimbursement for, and to date, Partners has not disallowed or made any kind of claim that they could not recover for those.
I mean, this raises a concern for me, speaking for myself and not on behalf of my colleagues, that the process that was originally used when there were serious deficiencies identified allowed for corrective action, which is consistent with the CACFP regulations. And Partners in Nutrition, according to MDE, provided a satisfactory corrective action such that they were reinstated and there was no problem going forward. But this time, that didn't happen. And that piece of the, that due process piece is missing here. So why did MDE's process afford sufficient due process to Partners?
So I think
before
there's
termination.
Two pieces on that. So first of all, Your Honor, as you've just identified, I think this only applies to specifically the termination decision and not
yes.
the actual denials.
Yes.
So as it relates to the termination decision, I think there's two answers to that. The first is that the corrective action that they had received informed them that going forward, they weren't going to receive the same type of possibility of a corrective action. They
had to fix the authority of MDE to do that?
I believe that the language in the statute and the regulations indicates that once they've had the opportunity for a cure or to correct, if they are no longer correcting that, then the institution does not have a right to a second or third or fourth or fifth termination decision.
Is there some language that you can point me to in the regulations that says that?
I don't know that there's a specific language in the regulation. I think that that's the natural. I don't know that there's any other regulation that I can think of where somebody is told, here you have an opportunity to cure. I think of it kind of like a last chance agreement that somebody might have in an employment situation.
Mr. Weiner, I didn't read the appeal panel's evaluation of that to... To me, they read it to a new violation. I didn't read the analysis to be kind of an ongoing, and we're going to go back to the prior violation. And isn't it true that under the regulations, even if one has failed to correct, they still can continue to operate while they finish their appeal period? So they're still, even at that point, not an immediate termination as was done here. So even that would be wrong if we were to... I just don't read the record that way. To me, it looked like a new notice on that May 20, whatever date letter, and with immediate termination.
So I think it goes to the second piece that I didn't have a chance to respond to, Your Honor, which is that the OMB regulations do provide a second opportunity or a second ability for an agency, and in this case, the state of Minnesota, Department of Education, when there is systematic and widespread irregularities, not necessarily fraud. If there's fraud, there's very specific regulations that apply in that situation. But irregularities that relate to the entire grant that we keep talking about, or award, as we're talking about here. And again, we're not talking about one site, two sites, 10 sites. We're talking about sites as it relates to 600,000 children in the state of Minnesota. The
but
OMB
regulations... Doesn't mean, unless it's fraud or a public... health safety allegation, notice is still required, opportunity to correct, and then if it isn't corrected, still an appeal period while they continue to operate the program.
I think that notice is required. I don't think that the regulation or the language in 226 applies in that situation. I think in that situation, the OMB regulation that allows for, and I think the specific language is, a federal award may be terminated in whole and part as follows. If the federal entity fails to comply with the terms and conditions of the federal award. And that is...
Does that get to the issue that the panel was discussing? It perhaps ignores the statutory governing language, by the way, which seems to require a hearing, again, but for the language in the statute, which mirrors the regulation in emergency. But are you now referring to the analysis the appeal panel made between the regulations that they don't differ and hence we go to the OMB?
That they complement each other in this situation.
Can you
Your
explain?
Honor.
For the life of me, I have not been able to understand the complementing or supplementing in answer to the question, are they different? Because I assume you would agree they're different. That's why just now you shifted from the regulation, the CACFP, if I get my initials right, back to the OMB because they differ and we don't need to follow that different one. So how does complementing, what's the difference between complementing and different?
So in The CACFP regulations set forth some specific situations where the department must follow certain situations, and that includes situations where there's fraud, those types of situations. They are also permissive in the sense that there are certain situations where the language allows for broad reasons for denial. And we see that in the statutory language in section 1766, D1E, III I, where a permanent agreement described in this clause may be terminated for convenience by the institution or state agency that is a party to the permanent agreement. And I think what we have here is the OMB regulations kind of serve as a safety valve for those situations that aren't particularly specifically contemplated by the CACFP USDA regulations. And
Go
ahead.
I was just going to say, what is your authority for that, though? I feel like you're reading things into the regulations that I'm not seeing.
I think that, well, I think where we see it is the first we can see it in the plain language and the way that the language or the statutes complement each other. There's the permissive language throughout the regulations about when the department may do things, and there's language where it must or shall do things. There are the continuous cross-references between the USDA regulations, the CACFP regulations, and the OMB regulations. And there's the language in the OMB regulations that specifically indicate that unless there's a specific exemption that they apply to these matters, unless there's something very specific that says otherwise. And it's very clear that CACFP is not exempted in the two, it's in 200-101E, and the idea there is that interest of maximum uniformity. When we're talking about situations that involve systemic failures of an award, of a program, there's the safety net to say, all right, you know what, we can put a pause on this. You still get notice, you still have an opportunity to be heard, but you don't have the same opportunity to cure as you do under the CACFP regulations in those situations.
Go ahead.
Does that is that amount to a conflict, though? So that has to be resolved according to our traditional conflict analysis?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because in this situation, the language is not, there's language specifically as it relates to the fraud situation, and there's language that relates to the broader statutory language as it relates to Part 200, the OMB regulations. And because of that, the court can and should read those regulations to complement each other and in conjunction with each other as opposed to something separate.
I'm still not understanding complementing. We look at the 200-101, is it C, parens D, governing provisions, that when a regulation differs, then we look to the regulation. It seems consistent with the USDA statute, so it seems to me irrelevant what exemptions are in 200 under OMB because it's already been exempted by the statute and now the regulations. So now we look at these regulations, and it looks like there's no dispute, but that the serious deficiency notice was given, which triggers the regulatory USDA regulatory process of a notice, and then if it's not cured, then another notice, I think the phrase is intention to terminate or whatever the phrase it is. And so, why wouldn't we just look at that, see if it's followed, and stop? Because it's different from the language that you're arguing now and did argue below, and the appeal panel referred to.
So, Your Honor, I think the issue is when you have if the CACFP regulations considered and were intending to address wholesale failure of an institution, that would have been specifically included in those regulations, and it's not. And because of that—
Isn't that what a serious deficiency is?
Serious deficiency, I think, is something different. It's a specific concern about a process.
The list seemed to be what the specific things that were why claims were denied, and you're not keeping track of the records, and you, et cetera, in your site information, and that was the notice. Let me ask, in either regulation, is this phrase institution? I can't remember the phrase you just used now, which will then implement a different regulation.
Your Honor, the language institutional failure or systematic failure, I think was the term, isn't in the regulation. I think that what we see is it is consistent with the intent of the OMB regulation, which is to provide for uniformity for federal awards throughout. I think that's where we see it. I see I have less than a minute, so I just want to touch very briefly on the other issue, which is even if the court were to determine that there was an issue on the termination piece, as it relates to the specific denial of the 700-plus claims that are here, the burden there is now and always is on partners. They haven't met that burden. The department has shown by substantial evidence that partners has claimed that they sponsor sites serving over 70% of the children in Minnesota. And the regulations required it to review site submissions and only claim reimbursement when the documentation supported that claim. And it was MDE's determination that partners failed to do this and failed in its duty to support that substantial evidence. And for that reason, the claim on the specific denials should be affirmed. I see my time's up, so unless there's any other questions, I'll take a seat.
I have one more question, Council. It's just not clear to me why it is that MDE didn't follow the appeal panel's direction on May 17 to terminate pursuant to the CACFP regulations. Why didn't MDE do that?
Your Honor, I don't know what the answer to that question is. I think it could have. I think it ultimately made a determination based on the other regulations, but I'm not privy as to the rationale behind that.
Okay. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Council. Council for Relator, you may now approach and begin rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Frisch, I think I know the answer to your question. And that is that there was a media firestorm about the CACFP program, and MDE freaked out. And they wanted to terminate partners just as fast as they could, any way that they could. And so they picked this other path because they thought it was faster. Unfortunately, it was legally erroneous. And to be clear about the relief that we want here, the May 27th termination decision was a violation of law and should just be flat reversed. As to the claim denials, those should be reversed and remanded so that MDE can go through the process of apportioning proper versus improper claims, as I discussed earlier.
Is it MDE's burden to sort of figure out from the documents that were submitted what claims are valid and what claims aren't? Why isn't it your burden? Once the termination comes in, you're appealing the denial comes in, you're appealing the denial. Why isn't it incumbent upon your client to say, this denial was incorrect for these following reasons, and here's the documentary support?
And so it is our burden, claim by claim, to produce that evidence. And I believe in the record, in many cases, we did. For example, have to do an audit each year in order to determine what part of our administrative budget is compensable. And as part of that audit for fiscal 22, needed to figure out how much of the claim dollars here were touched in any way by any of the parts of the federal indictment or the federal criminal investigation. Over half of those dollars were untouched by that. So we have a burden to meet that standard of proof, but we also have to have the ability to interact with MDE in a way that where we can satisfy that burden. And there's nothing interactive about the fact-finding here. Once we get past the papers, the hearing in this case is 1 hour. No testimony is permitted. It's before a group of three non-lawyer employees of the MDE. This is not a Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act proceeding. And so the fact-finding for us in order to interact and respond to questions when the 190 different claims just say ingredients, not meals, that's very difficult for us to do. But we did, in the third appeal, with that spreadsheet, we did attempt to do exactly that. And at minimum, I think a remand is necessary to allow MDE and partners to do what MDE in the first appeal, the appeal panel, said that they could do, that quote that I read. I would like to talk about the issue of the interaction between these OMB and USDA regulations. If the statute commands that you follow the USDA regulations, this interaction between them does not matter because the statute controls. Additionally, there is a good policy reason for why Congress in the School Lunch Act would want to make the termination and suspension procedures more rigorous, because in those cases, if you shut off the flow of funds just like that, which is what MDE tried to do twice, that affects hungry children eating or not eating. That's different than whether or not a library gets a grant or a road construction project moves forward. And so there are reasons why Congress chose to exclude this from the uniformity that the OMB regulations would suggest. Moreover, it is not the case that the regulations are, as counsel suggests, complementary. The OMB regulations talk about what happens if the terms of the federal award are not satisfied. The USDA regulations have a list of items A through U that are all of the different ways in which there can be a serious deficiency, and A through U completely overlay the OMB failure to meet the conditions of the award. And so they are talking about the exact same territory, but with completely different procedures. Procedures that require a hearing before termination rather than after, that require that if there's a suspension, you have to appoint a suspension monitor, essentially kind of like a bankruptcy trustee, to try to make sure that the program is still going and that the children are still being fed. And so it is not the case that they get to choose one or choose the other path. There is one path, and it is the USDA path, and that path was absolutely violated when they switched courses on May 27th. For these reasons, Your Honors, unless the court has any other questions, we would ask that the court reverse in the second appeal and reverse and remand in the first and the third appeals and resolve the case in that way. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your attempt to make some concision out of the voluminous record and your answers to our questions here today. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You have a good day.